Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Does every generation fear for the souls of the young? Is there something inherent in today's digital capabilities that makes the ideals of generations past no longer apply? MacArthur genius and Harvard education professor and psychology professor Howard Gardner explores the impact of postmodern thinking and new technology in a new book called Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. Always a pleasure to have Howard Gardner on the show. Welcome back to our studios.
Thanks, Brian. Happy to be here.
And talk about taking on no small things, truth, beauty, and goodness reframed. How many books is that?
Well, it's only one book, but I guess you're hinting at the fact that it, in some sense, a culmination of a lot of thinking I've done about education over the years. About 10 years ago, I wrote a book which was, in a sense, a naive book. I said the purpose of education is to help us understand what's true and what's not, what's beautiful and what's not, what's good and what's evil. And it was naive in the sense that I took those concepts more or less for granted, as many of us do in daily life. But I was then critiqued by many people who said, who are you to say what's true? How do you know what's good? It's different among the Bongo Bongo than it is among people living in Boston. And then with my own eyes and ears, I watched the rise of the internet, of social networks, multi-user games, virtual reality, and even to my naive mind, it was clear that when there's so much stuff around, so many voices in cyberspace, things are changing so quickly that I couldn't simply assume that truth, beauty, and goodness were the way they were back in the old days. So that's the meditation of the book.
Well, are you arguing that Wikipedia and Twitter and Photoshop somehow pose a threat to truth, beauty, and goodness?
Yes. To truth in the sense that, you know, there used to be an encyclopedia you would go to and it would be quite stable and you read the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica and that's the way it was. Or speaking of that's the way it was, you'd watch Walter Cronkite on television at night and he would end his broadcast by saying that's the way it was. And this is not to say that everybody believed everything they read or everything that they heard or saw on television. But there weren't so many voices. If I put an entry on Wikipedia now, it can change within minutes. In fact, I watched my own biography evolve over 3 years, and I can say absolutely accurately that it didn't get more accurate over the years until finally I had some friends intervene. When it comes to goodness, cyberspace is really the Wild West. There's no way of really determining whether somebody's identity is genuine. There's no way of regulating who owns what. It's so easy to circulate any kind of image, download any kind of information. And perhaps most intriguingly, once you enter cyberspace, you're in a world of unknown size and unknown duration. Once you create a bit, a trace, you can never know what's going to happen to it. And that runs havoc with our sense of what's good and bad. I think many people know about the suicides that have taken place because of false identities on the internet or circulation of images. And this would have been difficult to imagine decades ago before the digital world became a reality.
I'm a little surprised, I have to say, to hear you condemning digital life in these broad terms. I mean, I'm going to wind up on the other side of some of these issues from you, and I've talked about before how I'm surprised about this rash of internet fright books, as I call them, that seem to come out one after another after another. So just to take one of your examples and push back a little bit, on the question of the news, were we really better off when people got their news from Walter Cronkite, one middle-aged white man saying, and that's the way it is, as opposed to this proliferation of sources and points of view and opportunities to participate, as imperfect as it is and with the many inaccuracies that are out there. But there is a plethora of news sources now. And, of course, there's a crisis in professional journalism, no doubt. A crisis of reporting and the ability to get professionals out there and actually get stories, all those things are very real. But are we really better off going back to a time when there were just three major networks dominating news coverage and dissemination of information in this country?
Absolutely not. No, I'm going to end up, I don't know exactly where in relationship to you, but with a very different kind of conclusion than you've intimated. With respect to truth, I think that the potential for ascertaining truth is greater than it's ever been before if we're willing to work very hard to weigh sources very carefully, to keep on probing and pushing. But many people don't. There is what's called the big sort. There is the echo chamber, the mirror, and it's very easy to get locked into a birther world and never get out of it. But this is where formal education plays its most important role. If you learn the methods of the disciplines and the methods of professions, like journalism or law or teaching, then the chances of figuring out what's going on are greater than ever before. Whether we'll seize that opportunity is a separate question. Again, with respect to beauty, my conclusion is surprising, but I think very upbeat. The notion of a classic canon of beauty is over. But each of us now can cultivate our own sense of beauty because we have access to more images, more sounds, more creations than ever before. And the only reservation I have is that you have to be able to make discrimination. You have to be able to compare one object or experience to another before you declare something as being beautiful. With respect to goodness, that's the most complicated. How we relate to our neighbors, what I call neighborly morality, really doesn't change and hasn't changed. But because, as I said earlier, we now have access to the whole world of other human beings, how do we behave to people who we don't know personally, who we have no kind of relationship to? And that has to be forged kind of one error, one mishap at a time. And the issue is, can we work out new rules of the road, so to speak, with respect to belonging to a huge community, with respect to respecting privacy, with respect to knowing what's credible and what's not, with respect to ownership? I certainly don't think every image that's created should be copyrighted, nor do I think that about every poem. On the other hand, if everything can be circulated with no consequence, then the potential to create anything new becomes much reduced. So these are the issues I'm wrestling with. But I'm not at all a pessimist. What I'm trying to do is to rescue the core of truth, beauty, and goodness in the light of the postmodern critique on the one hand and the opportunities but also the perils of the digital media on the other.
We have a few minutes for your phone calls for Howard Gardner. Maybe you know his past work on multiple intelligences or some of his other things. And now he's written Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Maybe people under 25, let's say, or anybody who's a digital native wants to call in and see if you experience the same kinds of questions as seen through Howard Gardner's eyes, the same kinds of challenges for kind of framing and defining and coming to grips with the concepts of truth, beauty, and goodness as they are perceived and as they are experienced in this digital world. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And one of the things in the book that I noticed is that you notice that young people don't seem to have heroes anymore. And is it because we've come to see the individual as immaterial, that we're merely the sum of biological and economic forces? It's kind of a detachment from the idea of free will. Is that where you're going?
This is a place where I am a traditionalist. I think it's regrettable that it's very hard to get young people to declare heroes, except among people whom they know personally. And, of course, it's better to have a personal hero, a family friend or somebody on the block, than no heroes at all. I think the problem really is that nowadays almost everybody who's well-known, there's lots of dirt on. There's lots of pathography, as it's called. And so I think actually a more healthy attitude, which I try to encourage among young people, is to put together elements of different people. You may not admire Bill Clinton in every respect, but there's certainly lots to be admired from Bill Clinton. As you know, there's now a book out about Gandhi, which indicates some questionable aspects of his life, but it hardly means that you should throw Gandhi away. I had a very interesting experience at Harvard. I couldn't get students to mention a well-known person who was heroic to them. And after I just did wait time, finally somebody said Bill Gates. There then followed a half an hour argument, which I had to cut off, about whether Bill Gates was heroic. And of course, it had to do whether it was the Bill Gates of 20 years ago who took over Microsoft, or whether it was the Bill Gates who was trying to deal with global hunger. And, you know, the conclusion that we, or with health issues, was you don't have to admire everything about a person to be able to admire some fragments. So we came up with the phrase fragmentering, putting together heroes, not on just one person, but things that you can learn from different people. But I'd love to hear from some young listeners, if there are any in school.
Let's take a caller who is maybe a teacher. Kim in North Hallidon, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I am a teacher, and I was wondering what advice Dr. Gardner would have for those of us who are trying to help our students find these pieces of truth and goodness. What methodology he might point us in, because we are so constructed now with standards and testing, and, you know, how can we kind of find that space in our curriculum to do that?
I think the most effective way to deal with goodness is to create a community at the school where there are rules and regulations which are understood, which students can participate in, and where when crises arise, as they inevitably will, people get together and discuss them. It's what I call creating a commons. With respect to beauty, I have the notion of a personal portfolio where you note what you like and why from different areas of art and how that changes over time, because unless you're really stick in the mud, your tastes are going to evolve, and I think that's wonderful. With respect to truth, I think that's really the heartland of school, and the various disciplines try to inculcate different senses of truth. The historical truth is not the same as scientific truth, which is not the same as the truth of journalism. There, the job is both to indicate the methods that different disciplinarians and professionals use to ascertain truth, and then to use a big word, to help students become more metacognitive, to realize when somebody is making a claim, what's the evidence in which they're making the claim? Is it drawn from an appropriate discipline? Or, for example, if you're arguing in favor of, you know, Barack Obama having been born outside the United States, what's the evidence that you use, and how could you be proved right or wrong? If it's just a matter of faith or a matter of baloney, then that's not a truth warrant. But if you actually have a method for ascertaining it, then we can continue the discussion.
Kim, what do you think?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Sandy in Union Square, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, I'm a 22-year-old college student, so I'm under your 25 range. I'm just wondering why it's so important to have heroes that are famous or celebrities. I mean, oftentimes those people can end up being disappointing if you know more about them or you get to meet them personally. And for me, like, my heroes are a lot of my college professors, and I get to know them personally, and it's just much more meaningful. So why is that so important for them to be famous? Or
I won't argue against what you're saying. If there are people whom you like and admire and can learn from, I think that's wonderful. I guess the reason for talking about people who are well-known is not because they're well-known, but because they help us to realize what we can reach for. They serve as kind of ideals. So I had many teachers I admired, but the ones who stretched me the most, whether they were famous or not, were the ones that I think were most important. And another point of which I argue in the book is that individuals really do matter in terms of human history. It matters that a Gandhi was alive. It matters that an Einstein was alive. Probably Nelson Mandela is the most respected person in the world today. And I think we should be able to learn from them, as well as David Brooks says in his column today in the New York Times. Osama bin Laden shows us what happens when a person of great ability really takes the wrong turn. And we need to, I think, keep our eyes open there. But if you have people whom you admire and like and learn from, I think that's great.
You want to respond, Sandy?
Oh, just, you know, it's interesting. I just, I feel like I used to really admire, I still admire, but used to really, really admire this musician, Kathleen Hanna, who was really the leader in the Riot Girl, like, feminist rock music movement. And then when I got to see her speak several times, and I actually got to speak to her, it sort of, you know, I still admire her, but it took it down to a certain level because it was like, okay, she's just a regular person as well. But I guess for me, like my professors who are really distinguished in their field or just doing work that I really admire, that's like enough of a hero to me that I don't feel a need to admire. I mean, I admire lots of famous people, but I don't have a need to role model them.
Sandy, thank you very much for your call. You mentioned David Brooks. I should mention to everybody that Howard Gardner will be speaking with David Brooks on Truth, Beauty, and Goodness tonight at 8 at the 92nd Street Y. We have a link to where you can buy tickets on our website at WNYC.org. I also understand this is one of those 92nd Street Y events that will be simulcast by a video link to other cities. And one of those cities is Montclair, where you can go to the site where they're doing it in New Jersey and I guess see it for a lot less money than coming into the city and paying for a 92nd Street Y ticket. But David, that should be really good at the 92nd Street Y. David Brooks with Howard Gardner on Truth, Beauty, and Goodness tonight at 8. I want to ask how your observations about the web dovetail, if you think they do at all, with your other work on multiple intelligences. And I see that your publisher is releasing two of your multiple intelligences books. And for people who don't know the basic concept, and Dr. Gardner, tell me how much I'm, you know, massacring this, that we shouldn't view intelligence in the simplistic way that maybe it's measured on an IQ test and we think of intelligence in those terms. But you framed some various kinds of intelligences that we should see people as more or less adept at: visual spatial intelligence, bodily, kinesthetic, that would be movement intelligence, I guess, musical intelligence, interpersonal intelligence, intrapersonal intelligence, understanding one's own self, linguistic intelligence, and logical mathematical intelligence. So all those intelligences. How does your theory of multiple intelligences dovetail with your observations about the web? Are some of the intelligences particularly adaptable to life on the web or newly necessary, or where would you start?
I think the web is actually a terrific playground for many intelligences and for many intelligences used in new ways. If you compare it to a situation in a classroom where it's the teacher lecturing to the students with students occasionally answering, on the web you have access to all kinds of pictorial information, still as well as motion. You have you can relate to different kinds of musical tracks from all over the world. And given Web 2.0, we aren't simply taking information in. We can create information. You know, we can create works. We can post them. We can Photoshop them. We can enter a virtual reality where we can use our bodily intelligence and our spatial intelligence. So it's a fantastic playground. I guess what your question stimulates in me is thinking about the personal intelligences, because we evolved to know people directly, face-to-face, about 150 people, according to what we learned from scientists. And we still have to work out what does it mean to relate interpersonally to people whom we only know online, who we have no direct kind of personal information about from having seen them and being able to, watch them when the camera isn't on them, so to speak. And this is why people like Sherry Turkle coined phrases like alone together, because even though we are networked and connected all the time, the question is the sense of person which we evolved to have over thousands of years, knowing other people, knowing ourselves, is that being altered in ways which are still not understood? And again, not to come off as a Luddite or a troglodyte, I'm not saying that things were good in the old days. What I'm saying is they have to be recomputed, reconfigured, reframed in my title in terms of the digital media. We can't just ignore them. But you know, people used to say, well, I taught the kid, and if he didn't understand it, that's his problem. Now on the net and the web, there's so many ways you can present information, and there's so many ways in which we can show what we know that I think it's fantastic for education. And those schools or those distance learning companies which really learn to exploit many ways of teaching and many ways of showing what you've learned are going to have huge leg up in places which still think there's only one way to teach, and if you can't learn that way, that's your fault. And you mentioned this age of standardized tests. Our tests are really tests for the 19th and 20th century. We haven't begun yet to figure out how to assess our students using the full range of capabilities of the web and the internet and social media.
Well, Howard Gardner, still thinking, tackling newness where he finds it, and the deep questions of truth, beauty, and goodness. Reframe, the title of his new book, subtitle Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. And again, Howard Gardner will be speaking with David Brooks on truth, beauty, and goodness tonight at 8 at the 92nd Street Y. We have placed a link to where you can buy tickets on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Professor Gardner, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we conclude today with Kurt Anderson on redesigning Monopoly. In fact, how would you redesign Monopoly? If you can't think of anything right off the top of your head, call in and tell us where you might move the game to. It's still based in Atlantic City, you know. Would you shift it to somewhere else? You can start calling now. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And Kurt Anderson from Studio 360 on redesigning Monopoly right after this.